Welcome to Private Equity Perspectives, a podcast by BDO USA's private equity practice. Each episode, BDO connects with leaders in the private equity space to discuss the latest trends driving deal activity, fund strategies, and portfolio company optimization.
Hello, and welcome to BDO's Private Equity Perspectives podcast, where we explore the trends impacting private equity today. I'm Todd Kinney, National Relationship Director in BDO's Private Equity Practice. Today, for our 50th episode, a huge milestone, we're joined by Monica Mantilla, President and CEO at Altura Capital, and Lloyd Metz, Managing Director at ICV Partners. Before we get into our discussion topics, I just want to say that I'm very excited and proud to be hosting our 50th episode of the podcast. Really quite an achievement for BDO. And I would really like to thank everyone supporting the podcast behind the scenes since episode one. So thanks so much. So in this special episode, Monica and Lloyd will discuss their investment approaches, the evolution of their respective firms, the impact of specialization on the lower middle market, and approaching the headwinds we're seeing in 2025. We're also going to get to hear their expectations for the rest of the year, as we like to do with all of our guests. So just a quick reminder to our listeners that the remarks and opinions of our guests do not necessarily represent BDO's views. So with all that out of the way, Monica, why don't you kick us off here? You're co-founder and CEO at Altura Capital, as I mentioned. Perhaps you can tell our listeners a bit about your firm and your role. And I know that Altura focuses on businesses in the lower middle market across four verticals. So perhaps you could expand on this a bit and delve into your investment approach for these types of companies.
Thank you, Todd. Excited to be here today. Very appreciative of the invitation. So to tell you a little bit about Altura, we describe ourselves as a values and results-driven business enabler. And we do that through being an investment platform. We have a 20-year solid history of delivering results and keeping promises. And we are led by a group of people that unite close to 440 years of collective experience in private equity and private debt, in company building. And what we do is that we team up with institutional investors, with entrepreneurs, with corporations, and with accomplished executives to cultivate scalable enterprises. And we provide them with a specialized toolkit and the right financial support. And our market is only U.S. today, at least, and we operate in what is described as the small and mid-sized businesses, so the lower middle market. And we have an emphasis on four verticals that are the areas where, you know, we have teams, we have advisory boards, we have corporate relationships, and we have knowledge and expertise of those verticals that allow us to, you know, have solid investment thesis and try and look for opportunities there. And those four verticals are consumer, business services, specialty manufacturing, and healthcare. We love to not only deliver returns, but deliver impact in looking for opportunities that have been historically overlooked, underdeveloped. And we also love to create high quality jobs. So we've been at it for 20 years, as you describe, and excited about the future ahead.
Awesome. So great to have you here, Monica.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for the invitation.
Of course. Lloyd, turning over to you, my friend, is managing partner at ICV Partners. Perhaps you can introduce yourself, your firm, explain your role, and share a bit about what ICV Partners looks for when making investments. And I know that ICV has a few preferred niches, so would love to hear how you prioritize those within the current market.
Hey, Todd, thanks for the opportunity. Really glad to be here. Good to be on the same stage with Monica. So I've known Monica for a while, and so this is great. I've been at ICV Partners for, 20 plus years. I'm not going to count, not going to give an exact number because I don't keep track. But the firm has been around since 1999. We've always been focused in the lower end of the middle market. We're a buyout firm in terms of strategy, and lower end of middle market, we're looking at companies with 25 to 150 million of revenue, generally 5 to 20 million of EBITDA. And we're really focused on being the first institutional capital. So we're looking for family and founder-led businesses and corporate divestitures. And we actually have working investment theses inside of these verticals. And those are business services, consumer services, and food and beverage. And within those industry verticals, we have some working theses that are more specific. So for example, in business services, we are really keen on transportation and logistics, and we have some working theses there. We're looking at businesses that address the needs as it relates to governance, regulatory, risk, and compliance for corporations and enterprises. And we are looking and have invested in companies that are facilities and infrastructure services, maintenance services. So those are examples of some of the subsectors or working investment theses inside of one of our three industry verticals. We can get into it later, but we have evolved quite a bit. We like to think in terms of evolutions over the course of the many years that we've been in business at ICV. And I'm happy to get into some more details about that, but that's how we think about it. We're always trying to get better. We're always trying to improve upon our performance, hone our skills, and improve our craft.
All right. Well, it's great to have you here as well, Lloyd. And when I invited you both to the podcast, I did not know that you guys have some history together. So that's pretty special and should add to the conversation. So, well, in the spirit of milestones and growth, you've both been with your companies for many years. I know, Lloyd, you said you're not counting, but it's been over 20 years for you. And Monica founded Altura 20 years ago as well. So I wanted to ask both of you, how have your firms evolved since you began? And can you tell us a bit about how you settled into your respective niches and focus areas? And Monica, I'll let you take this topic first.
Thank you, Todd, and great to be with you, Lloyd. We've known each other and our firms have known each other for 20 plus years. So it's great to be all here together. And BDO has been a wonderful partner of ours as well. So I'm honored to be invited. So about the history, we started with a goal of serving institutional investors, and that has never changed, right? And we began with a model where we were actually more than asset managers. We were consultants and data providers. It was a time 20 years ago when institutional investors didn't really have access to good data, quantitative and qualitative data of what was described at that time as emerging firms, right? Smaller investment management firms that were delivering great returns, but they were like below the radar screen of institutional investors. So we wanted to build a tool that we thought at that time brought parity of information and ability for smaller firms to be able to be identified by large institutional investors. Then came the financial crisis of 2008, 2010. Our business changed dramatically. It's interesting when you have these pivotal historical moments, you have great challenges and at the same time, great opportunities. And at that time, we had the great opportunity to begin to provide services to large institutional investors, including U.S. Treasury, who at that time had bought hundreds of positions in banks, and many of them were small banks, regional banks. We did a lot of research around capital flows into small businesses and the role of regional banks and smaller banks. And it was really a fascinating time to understand and develop a thesis around what is the right capital structure for small businesses and what are the type of patient capital and strategic solutions that small businesses need in order to grow and thrive. And we developed an investment thesis and started developing in 2010. We really officially launched the fund in 2015. We went to the SBA with a track record. We got what is known as an SBIC fund, which is leverage capital that the SBA provides when you bring institutional capital alongside. And it really allowed us to hone a thesis around what is it that a small business or a middle market business needs to be able to thrive? And our goal and our deep desire was to be that capital partner to be able to come up with the right optimal capital structure, the combination of debt and equity, but very importantly, give them a series of tools that would allow them to grow faster. And we've been honing, you know, for decades now, what we describe as the Altura way, which is a methodical way to really think about the strategic planning of the organization. How are they going to grow revenue and EBITDA? How are they going to do, you know, thorough sales and marketing plan, operations, financial discipline, human capital, risk management, technology, you know, everything that is required to build a firm. And we're not managing these organizations. We actually are always entrusting, you know, highly capable CEOs and management teams to do that. We're just there to help them and be sitting at the board, play a strategic advisory role in helping them to grow. So I think that the journey of these 20 years has been one where our role is to deliver to our investors and to keep the promises we make. And it's truly an honor and something that I feel immensely proud, and I attribute to the team and its culture and its results the fact that we have some incredible partners in the journey that understand the value creation we bring and are there every day with us in a proactive way. The journey is one of building tool sets, right? Every day becoming bigger and better, faster, more agile, understanding better the verticals where we're in, bringing the right human capital to the organizations that we invest in, bringing the right capital structure and delivering results. I think that behind all of this is a commitment to building a certain set of values and culture of how we behave in the market and how we show up to our investors, to our entrepreneurs, to the ecosystem we're part of, to be able to ultimately achieve our purpose as a firm, which is to bring above market returns and also in tandem, bring societal change.
All right. Well, Monica, thanks so much. A lot of good points in there. I'm actually starting my 22nd year with BDO, and as quickly as time flies by, certainly you accomplish a lot and see a lot in a couple of decades, and your bigger, better, faster, more agile comment could not be more relevant to myself and BDO as well. So we appreciate that. Lloyd, turning to you, since you started at ICB, how has the firm evolved? And you started to get into this earlier, but is there anything you can share about how you came to focus on your respective niches and focus areas?
Yeah, so that is part of the evolution. When you go and think about where we started, it was focused on the lower middle market. And quite honestly, it was not industry focused. It was industry agnostic. You might call it a generalist approach. We had some specific business characteristics that we looked for in each opportunity. So we had a certain point of view on margins and an absolute kind of threshold of high EBITDA margins and high cash flow generation and what that would imply about the quality of a business. We wanted to back the existing management teams. We wanted market leadership. We wanted a history of stable growth in revenues and profits. And so we did have some specific business characteristics that we looked for. Over the arc of 20 years, again, we've gone through evolutions where we started to develop points of view as to business models and industries that we liked more versus less. And we started to gravitate toward those industries and business models that we liked more. We added additional elements to the business characteristics that we liked more and ones that not only did we not like, we just avoided completely. And right. So with these evolutions, we can talk about it from a decades point of view or a series of years, we started to hone in and lock in on the industry verticals that we're currently in. And we made some experiments in other industries. And again, you have to evolve and be agile, I think you mentioned earlier. And so when a particular industry is perhaps specializing faster than you are, you have to rethink that. If you're not as competitive for a variety of reasons as others in a space, then you have to think about that and rethink that decision. Part of the evolution has also been how we conduct our business, how we pursue opportunities, how we cultivate relationships with our service providers, with investment bankers, with board members. We have independent board members on all our portfolio companies. So just learning how to and developing your way of bringing the right board members to a portfolio company to address their needs, to be a mentor, if need be, of the CEO. We've gone through all of that. We've also evolved the way we think about our own human capital approach as well as portfolio company approach, and have spent many, many years and many iterations revising how we interview, revising how we make assessments of ourselves, our hiring, as well as the hires we make at portfolio companies. So we've spent a lot of time on the human capital and the psychology around hiring, decision-making that we just did not do back in 1999, 2000, 2001. But through all those evolutions, there are certain elements that I think are just true to who we are. And sometimes that's also a big part of your growth as a firm, is deciding what to hold on to. And one of the things that I think was formative for ICV is that the very first investment that the firm ever made closed on September 13th, 2001. And quite honestly, that set a tone for the firm, and that's carried through, as I think, over the decades, where we don't panic. We don't hide and stick our head in the sand when things get choppy or downright scary. We sold a company and made a very nice return in 2008. We bought a business back, actually, in 2008, 2009, and expanded that business through 2010. We made investments in 2010, in the beginning of 2010. We closed on investments in March of 2020. So we've seen enough market cycles, valuation cycles, interest rate environments, economic environments, and we don't waver, we don't get weak in the knees, and we've been able to be successful. And I think holding on to that part of our experience, history, and culture is super important and something we're very proud of.
Having joined BDO in 2003, Lloyd, I think ICV is one of the first PE firms I started working with. So it's been a lot of fun to watch all of your evolutions and certainly the success along the way. Again, I know we're not counting years, Lloyd, but it's been fun to ride along ICV.
I appreciate the partnership, Todd. And no, you will not get a number out of me.
Yeah. All right. Well, sticking with the topic of your firms, I think it would benefit our listeners to hear a case study from each of you about a portfolio company you're especially proud of your work on. Let's have each of you walk us through, let's say, the pre-acquisition state, key challenges it faced, the strategic initiatives you implemented, and how it ultimately performed under your leadership. Lloyd, since you went second last time, why don't you kick us off with this case study topic?
Okay, Todd. So there's one that is relatively recent that I'm just really proud of the work that we did with this business. They are a marine spare parts logistics company. They are effectively a travel agent. This is the way I explained it to my kids. They are a travel agent for parts for ships. So if a ship breaks something or breaks a rudder, a propeller, a stabilizer, a gear shaft, or whatever it is, an antenna, figures out where to get the replacement, which could be somewhere in Germany or Canada or in Seattle, Washington, and how to get it to that ship that is heading to a particular port anywhere in the world. And it needs to get to that port in a certain time window on a date certain. And they move these parts by ocean or by air, primarily by air. And that is a business that we found very interesting from some of our previous experience investing in air freight logistics businesses. This particular case was a family-owned business. The CEO, his dad was the founder. And he had ideas and dreams to expand the business and professionalize the business. And his siblings were not as risk tolerant. And so that gave rise to finding a capital partner to not only give some liquidity to his siblings and him a little bit, but really to find a partner to help him on this journey to build and grow his business. It was a global business headquartered in New York City, but had associates and affiliates across the country and outside of the US and Europe and Asia. In the summer of 2019, we consummated our transaction and partnered. We went through a bit of a courtship and we had great chemistry. He was a competitive, highly competitive college basketball player. And so being direct in terms of communication, direct in terms of expectation, asking for help and guidance, those were strong suits for him. So our chemistry was quite good. And so we embarked on upgrading everything from billing and collections to rebuilding the MIS, the technology system that the business ran on. It needed to be rewritten and upgraded, brought into the 21st century. We upgraded talent, bringing in a couple of CFOs. We had to find the right CFO for the business. We ultimately wound up hiring a chief technology officer. That took some convincing that that was an important role. And some sales leadership was brought in. And then we also closed out three acquisitions, one in Argentina that serviced the cruise ships that go to Antarctica, another business on the West Coast of the United States, as well as strengthening an outpost in Houston that we already had, and then a very large transformational one in Europe, which covered most of Western Europe. So it was analogous to our business and very similar. And so in the course of all of that, that was about 5 years almost to the day, we grew that business meaningfully from, let's call it, 8 of EBITDA to something approaching high 20s, approaching 30 of EBITDA. And the business was stronger, more global, more agile, running on a 21st century technology platform. And we couldn't have been more proud of how his team took the guidance, took the hand-holding, took the advice, and actually, more importantly, I would say, took the encouragement that we gave them to take the risks and build the business in a way that I don't think they believed or had confidence could be done. So super, super proud of them. They are now on to their next private equity partner who has ambitions to continue the growth trajectory that they've established.
Well, that's a great story. And Lloyd, thanks for sharing that and congrats on that exit.
Thank you.
And Monica, I appreciate your patience over there. So we'd love to hear a success story from Altura. Perhaps you can share the impact you all made, starting with the company's state before acquisition, the biggest obstacles it faced, and then really the key strategies you applied, and finally, the resulting impact.
Sure. Great story, Lloyd, of building value there. So the story that I chose to talk about today is a story of a Hispanic brand, Puerto Rican bread. If you are from Puerto Rico, if you've lived there, it's a brand that everybody recognizes. It's like a little bit of the island, and it's called Sidrines. And Sidrines was a family-owned business. When we did our investment, it was probably 2.5 decades or 3 decades in the making. It was a family that started with a small bakery and then grew and grew to the point where they had built the largest bread manufacturer in Puerto Rico. And the owner had some deep desires to come to the United States, but was frustrated with trying to do it. And they had like 14 points of distribution in Florida. It was difficult to come into the U.S. market. And when we did our partnership, when we did the investment, the goal was to envision and create the architecture and the plan around entering successfully the United States. And we helped them open doors with corporate America. We had great meetings with big retailers and discussed how and the conversations shifted from the price of the loaf to, can we build a manufacturing facility in the U.S.? And we did. We actually helped them build a manufacturing facility that is now double the capacity of the largest bread manufacturer in Puerto Rico. And today now serves all 50 states. We have thousands of distribution points across the country. And it really has been the perfect example of a great product with a great management team, with the right corporate partners that saw the vision and accompanied us in this long-term development of brand, of distribution, logistics, manufacturing capability in the U.S., and the right patient capital, right, to be able to put that into execution. It was a wonderful, proud moment when we did the inauguration in Lakeland, Florida, a few years ago, and we had the, you know, private jets of corporate America that were the big supporters coming and being with us in celebrating that accomplishment. And I think that those types of stories exemplify the potential that resides in our communities, right? It's in the segment of consumer. It's in the theme that we've carried through for decades around ethnic food. And we also are big believers in ethnic beauty. There's segments that we have worked very closely with large retailers and mid-sized retailers and smaller retailers around the country, trying to develop brands that are able to grow at the same pace that their demands and that the market demands them to grow with great quality of product. And it's a story that we love to tell.
Well, thanks, Monica. That's another awesome story. I really appreciate all the detail and candidness and transparency you both shared in your case studies. Trust me, from previous episodes, the listeners really sponge and love the case studies. So appreciate that. But I'm going to zoom out now for this next question. We're certainly seeing increasing specialization in private equity with firms developing distinct approaches like both of yours. So how do you think this trend will impact deal dynamics and competition in the middle market over the next few years? And looking ahead, what major shifts do you anticipate in how firms differentiate themselves and create value in the lower middle market? And Monica, why don't you kick us off first on this one?
So we are in a world where we deliver flexible capital, right? So it's predominantly private credit, but we love to combine it with equity because then we can have upside potential, but we have downside protection with the credit tools that we put into the structures that we build. In the private credit, as we all know, has been growing significantly throughout the last 3 years. Probably we've seen many institutional investors that didn't have private credit integrated into their strategies. And so it definitely is a segment that can grow, and very especially in the lower middle market. I feel that we play a very important role in the growth of potential of companies that otherwise would just have to go to banks and to lenders and informal equity providers that don't really have the ability together to put that full package, right, of optimal capital structure and the right strategic resources. We always tell the companies we work with, you know, take everything you can from a bank. We will begin where the banks, and we actually team up very well with many banks across the country where we work together to put together the right optimal structure. When I think about what's ahead and where we like to compete and where we see that entrepreneurs gravitate to us and we to them, is in spaces where we see alignment, right? In spaces where there is growth, an opportunity to double, triple the sizes of firms. And we are impact investors, and we love being impact investors because we think that it aligns us with that commitment of long-term value creation. And I'm always thrilled when I see that our impact thesis has become a competitive advantage, where entrepreneurs see in us a trusted long-term partner. We don't go ballistic when a quarter is not working well. We sit down and we think through it with the management team. And being a trusted partner, I think, is at the essence of the success of what we do, because yes, we'll have home run deals where everything grows quickly and naturally. And there will be others where there are changes that happen, right? We all went through what COVID had us do with companies that had to quickly pivot and transform themselves and attend to needs that nobody would have said the quarter before that would have existed, right? So trust and that ability to communicate effectively, to be guided by the same principles, to rely on data analytics, you know, solid business plans that we can then review together if there is a need to do so. But at the essence, I think that this ability to build trust and long-term relationships, long-term partnerships is what really holds us with our investors that we trust and trust us, and with our entrepreneurs that come to us because they see in us a trusted partner. So I think the market has changed, definitely has become more agile, and is going to become so much more agile with the coming of AI tools and technology tools. We're able to go through so much more data, so much faster, do due diligence in a much more agile way, look and find information and analyze information that before was so difficult to, or it just took time, right? And now it's at our fingertips. So I think that the future is absolutely fascinating. I think we're all going through deep transformational processes to understand how do we continue to build value and use all the tools that the market gives us today to be able to continue to do our work, right? Which is deliver above market returns and do it with impact. So fascinating world, the one we're in now, where there is a tremendous opportunity for value creation.
All right. Well, that makes perfect sense. Really appreciate all that color. So Lloyd, how do you feel about the trend toward specialization? You know, in what ways do you expect it to influence deal making and competition? And if you could close by just kind of looking ahead, how do you think firms will adapt to stand out, maximize value in the lower middle market?
Yeah, it's a good question because it's a trend that's been in place for quite some time and one that has some merits to it, right? If you become more specialized with respect to business model or industry, let's say, your network becomes tighter and better. Your pattern recognition should be better. It should be faster. Your OODA loop, right? Observe, orient, decide, act should get faster and tighter. And so you should be able to outcompete others. So that's sort of the benefit of the broad trend to specialization. And I don't think that really stops. For the lower middle market, though, it can be a little bit more nuanced because there are so many companies, right? So depending on your investment strategy, I think it starts to become a specialization around your investment strategy and the business models that fit better with your investment strategies. So if you are a acquisition intensive buy and build driven investment strategy, then becoming a specialist in that becomes the skill, not only the industry, but your ability to recognize, is this industry segment sufficiently fragmented for us to execute our strategy? And then how do you stand up integration capabilities as I'm building this platform becomes a skill that you have to be a specialist in. So it's almost like a meta set of skills that you're becoming a specialist over and above the industry, if that makes sense. So I think in the lower middle market, there's going to be more of that, right? If I'm focused on professional services companies, how do I execute a culture change faster? So becoming a specialist in that culture change execution, right? How do I upskill talent is going to be a little bit different at a professional services firm than it is at a manufacturing firm. So some of those nuances, I think, are going to become more important today and going forward. The other part of it, though, is it's still a lot of companies, thousands and thousands and thousands of companies in the lower middle market, and it's still a people-driven, emotional decision, particularly if you're going after family and founder-led businesses. And so bedside manner, general manners, temperament, personality, all of those things matter, and they're not going to resonate the same for everyone. So I could be the most expert in whatever industry segment, you name it. nobody knows more than me. Nobody's more plugged in than me. But if I meet you, Todd, and I piss you off or you just don't like my approach, as a business owner, you will say no, thank you. And so there's still going to be that dynamic at play in the marketplace.
You're way too kind and a gentle soul to piss me off, Lloyd, but thanks for throwing that out. And hey, I have to say, I'm sure our listeners will agree, you are the first one to reference the OODA loop on the podcast. So kudos to you.
I told you, you spent a lot of time on cognition and psychology, you know, so yeah.
Yeah. All right, Lloyd, I'm actually going to stick with you for this next one. I'll go to both of you, but the PE fundraising landscape is certainly evolving with traditional institutional investors becoming more selective. So given your firm's specialized approaches, both of you in the lower middle market, ICV and control investments, how are you positioning yourselves with investors?
Yeah, so we are positioning ourselves, I think, best with this evolutional mindset. So today is better than yesterday. This year will be better than last year. And going forward will be better. You know, will be our best year ever. That's the mindset that we have. And it is not a static mindset. We feel that we're a learning organization. We meet every September and have since inception in a retreat where we reflect on our performance, both the good and the not so good, areas for improvement, where we need to be headed. And so we've consistently done that for over 20 years, and we continue to do that. And I give that as an example of we're a learning organization, an evolving organization. So I think that's important. I also think it's very important to realize the value of experience across multiple cycles. Like I said, interest rate cycles, market valuation cycles, economic cycles, political cycles. We have invested in and through and on either sides of a wide range of market environments, and having that all-weather proven strategy and a steady hand on the wheel to navigate these environments, that matters. And so there should be value to that. We believe there's value to that. And that's what we think we offer to our LPs and prospective LPs.
All right, Lloyd, thank you, sir. Monica, same question to you. Altura is in the lower middle market with a focus across four verticals, which we've discussed, and a proactive approach to adding value. So within this selective and evolving PE landscape, and given your specialized approach, I guess two parts here. How are you positioning yourselves with investors, and are you seeing new opportunities or interest from different types of LPs?
I think that the strategy that we have been developing is one that holds a tremendous promise, and we see a very bright future. But we all know in the world of institutional investors, each and every one of those relationships takes decades, right, to build. And we're at a fortunate place where we have been able to develop incredible relationships with incredible institutional investors. And we have in-depth conversations with them around what we see in the market, how we are scaling up our firm, what is it that we see in the future that we can help make a reality, right, and gather opportunities and create value. Specializing and continuing to specialize in the four verticals where we're in, and seeing an opportunity to bring our very structured process of value creation into these firms, right? Again, I mentioned technology, and I think that technology and artificial intelligence will be phenomenal enablers for our firms and for the companies that we invest in. Many of the businesses we're in, right, we're in companies that are anywhere between 1 and 10, 15 million EBITDA. They're smaller, right? So they're not big firms in the world that can have millions of dollars invested in new technology. So they need to be very savvy in how is it that they can create efficiencies and reach market opportunities and go through data that they need for decision making in the most agile and cost-effective way. So we are partnering with all of them to come up with the right solution, right? And we're all going to be testing things and experimenting things and bringing the Altura way that we've had for decades into this recipe. But I think that you just have to continue to be completely devoted to what you're there to do, which is build value and understand the needs and the requirements of our institutional investors and satisfy those needs, exceed those needs, and continue to bring, you know, innovation and practical and agile value creation recipes. I think that that's what we will just continue to do. And all of that, I think that one of the things I'm excited about AI is leaving more room to do less of things that, you know, we all took time to do before that are now going to be at our fingertips, and then being able to put more time into creativity, into conversations and strategic thinking with our investors as to where we're headed together. I think that there's going to be an evolution and an acceleration of the lower middle market thanks to new tools and new resources coming to allow us to create value in hopefully an even better way than in the years ahead. So I truly am very, very excited about the type of themes that we're seeing. There's one investment thesis, for example, in the healthcare vertical where we've been investing for decades now, which is the women health and wellness vertical.
That's a good one.
We're 100 years behind, right? There's a lot of ability to create value there by bringing great business models with leaders that are putting these models together and these businesses together. And I think that there's just a bright future there that we are seizing, and we're excited to be part of.
All right, Monica, well, I appreciate you expanding on all of that. I'd like to pivot and talk to both of you a bit about the headwinds the industry has been faced with recently, as there are certainly plenty to consider. So Monica, I'm going to come to you first. Despite significant dry powder, deal activity remains selective in today's environment. So how are tariffs, economic uncertainty, and other headwinds shaping your approach to acquisitions? And has this changed how you evaluate opportunities or build your pipeline?
Yeah, I think that in today's market, you know, there is a lot of noise, right? There is a lot of change. Some are big believers in the benefits it will bring. Some are very afraid of what it can bring. We stick to our knitting, right? We are value creators. We identify great companies led by great management teams, and we help build value. And that will not change. I think that in times of uncertainty and change, we have an opportunity to have even more areas of value creation. So yes, there are lots of questions in the market today, but I think that, and we always, Jay and I share with the team every day, we see deal sourcing growing. We see value creation opportunities expanding. Many corporations that are changing the way they approach small or diverse firms, the ones that have been looking at them as value creators are not changing that view. And we're just sticking to the way we know how to build value. And there will be, you know, certainly an investment committee. We see some business models where we say, you know what, this is one where we should wait, right? Because there's uncertainty in where tariffs will end or where visas will end, or, you know, so there's a number of variables that in the market will lead us to be prudent on certain decision making. But there's straightforward value creation opportunities that we just see growing and that we're going to be continuing to see.
All right. Thanks, Monica. Lloyd, same question to you. How have these headwinds impacted ICB?
So the macro headwinds that you're talking about or referring to, we are seeing them as presenting opportunities for us to make new investments, as well as for some of our portfolio companies. I'll put it to you this way. I found that if you define the market as the actual capital markets, as well as what you hear in the business press, CNBC or what have you for short, a lot of business owners take their cues from that. And that raises their level of anxiety and often leads them to look for a capital partner, and that will give you the opportunity to engage and make an investment. So for us, this kind of environment tends to be a positive because it opens the door for investment opportunity. What we also find is in the lower middle market, depending on the size of the market and the nature of the business model, a lot of the macro elements don't always trickle all the way down. So obviously there are some businesses, regardless of business model, based on the customer base you're servicing or the niche or industry that you're playing in, some of these macro trends are going to hurt you and hit you. So we obviously screen that out. But for what's left, there's really nice opportunity. So we have a last mile delivery business in Canada. And in the most recent board meeting, we were encouraging them to tune out the noise and look at their actual business. They see a flow of packages coming from all over the world every day. And notice, how can you take advantage of the Buy Canada movement that sounds like it's emerging, right? And so they're starting to build their customer pipeline of companies that are producing stuff in the western part of Canada that need to get it delivered to the eastern part of Canada, and other companies that are in countries outside of the US that are servicing Canada. So anyway, it's a mindset that we have to remind a lot of our portfolio company leaders to tune out the noise and focus on what actually is happening in your business. I'll give you another example. We owned a consumer-facing business that that was in the midst of the 2008-2010, the Great Recession. And that CEO was listening to CNBC all the time and was, woe is me, woe is me. And I had to tell the CEO, like, look at your actual business, your business, the one that you run and control. And I got to tell you, Todd and Monica, that business did not have a down year as it relates to EBITDA as it went through 2008 through 10. And so that shift in mindset, that little bit of a nudge, that reminder to focus on this business that you can actually control is how you get those results. If you pay attention to the broader macro, sometimes that's not relevant to your specific business. And so on the investment part, that's an opportunity. Once we own a business and are partnering with that leadership team, it's also an opportunity, particularly as it relates to starting up a new facility or location or acquisitions.
All right. Well, I appreciate all that, Lloyd. As it turns out, we're nearing the end here, but I'd be remiss not to touch on this next topic with both of you. We're still seeing higher interest rates and, of course, overall market uncertainty. So how are you each navigating the current exit environment? Are longer holding periods changing your approach to value creation? What strategies are you using to address valuation challenges and position companies for future sale? Now, I know I just threw a lot out at both of you, so feel free to touch on whichever topics you feel are most relevant to you at this moment. So Lloyd, how about you start us off?
So I personally think the risk, as you think about the next 4, 5, 6 years, is that interest rates and inflation could be higher than expected. To me, that's the bigger risk to watch out for. And so as I think about the investments that we've made over the last 6-12 months, plus the level of debt has been fairly low, 1 to 2.5 times leverage, roughly. Mm-hmm. And we have intentions to try to keep it there until the businesses become materially larger, in which case they'll still be under-levered. So we sort of have that mindset at work here. And then second, we've been building plants and underwriting new investments with greenfield and brownfield expansion, with the idea that if you build a new production facility or service facility or however you want to think about it and own it, you should have tighter control, better control over your procurement, your production costs. And therefore, if and when inflation spikes, you should be able to mute that price spike better than if you didn't have that means of production under your control, if you were outsourcing it, let's say.
All right. Interesting angle. So Monica, how about you? How are you adapting your strategy with the exit landscape in flux? Are these longer hold periods reshaping Altura's value creation strategy You know, what tactics are you using to overcome valuation hurdles and prepare companies for a strong exit? So again, same as Lloyd, whatever's most relevant to you.
Yeah. So I think that we keep hearing, and I think it's become a reality that DPI is the new ROI, right? And so you certainly hear from institutional investors telling the market players, just not show me returns, only show me how much are you returning, how much capital are you giving me back, right, of what I gave you to invest. And we hear that, and we have also focused on being as agile as we can in that value creation process to be able to exit effectively. Our history has been one where mostly strategics have been the buyers of the businesses we've been in. Remember, we're both debt and equity, right? So the majority of our capital has been in credit. So it's, you know, we're not worried about the exit, we're worried about the payment. And then in the equity positions, building that value to be able to position at entry 1 to 2 million firm, to have it be at 3 to 5 million EBITDA, you know, you just are going to have better valuations, so many more players interested in buying that asset. And in the spaces where we navigate in these four verticals of, you know, consumer, business services, manufacturing, and healthcare, there is plenty of activity. We get approached frequently by strategics interested in some of our portfolio companies. We entertain those and give a company we believe is being paid the right number, we're open and eager to do that exit. I think that in that process, and you were asking us initially, you know, what's the road of value creation, right, and efficiencies that we've traveled, definitely that sense of being agile in adding value and exiting at the best pace possible is definitely one that we keep a close eye on. I think that part of the recipe has always been very strategic in add-on acquisition so that we can have the growth of the entity be there, but both organic and through acquisition. So in the space where we are, that deal activity hasn't tuned down. To the contrary, we see that it's actually very active. We've seen our sourcing numbers go up. We've seen our exits accelerate. And so it is a market, perhaps because it's just a little bit below the typical radar screen of private equity or middle market private equity. We see many players, for example, that they don't get in the 1 to 3 million EBITDA, right, where we do play. So it is a market where we've seen exits, where we tee up and work very hard every day to tee up these exits.
All right. Well, I appreciate all the additional color there, Monica. So as we wrap our 50th episode, we will close with this one, like most episodes that came before it, and that's our crystal ball question. So we're already nearly a quarter of the way into the year, and still no one knows exactly what we should expect for private equity. I know we've touched on it a little bit, but as we get further into 2025, what do you think is going to happen in the near term as far as transaction volume and exit strategy go, and any overall predictions for the industry or your respective firms? Lloyd, why don't you share your predictions first?
This is one of those moments where I miss Byron Wien, rest in power, and his, you know, 10 surprises that he would have published by now. So
right.
I could have cheated off of that. As it relates to deal volume, I'm not sure this tidal wave of deal activity that's been expected over the last, 2-3 years probably going on.
Right.
I'm not sure it happens. I think deal activity picks up. It's not completely dried up. There's still reasonable deal activity. I still think it picks up, but at a modest pace. And for our purposes, that's good enough to get some exits concluded, right? We have some teed up already that we're going through the process of getting them ready to go to market. I think it'll be fine. Again, I don't personally think the industry that should want a year like 2021 into 2022, which led to some of this indigestion that we're still sort of working our way through. So I think a modest, actionable market in 2025 is just fine.
Right. All right. Monica, what are your closing thoughts around what's to come for PE and Altura in 2025?
Yeah. So I think it's an exciting year. There are investment thesis in each one of the four verticals that we're going deep into, you know, with the help of our advisory board members, our executive operating partners, like, you know, partners in the industry that come together with us to find them and cultivate them. I think that there are lower middle market companies that still lack that patient capital partner and that strategic partner to get them to the next level. And that is who we are. Again, we are seeing lifting and increased numbers in sourcing. And so that excites us. And I think when entrepreneurs come to us with a vision and they say, look, we're at 1 to 5 million EBITDA, we have this growth vision, and this is what we need to achieve that. Can you be our partners? That for us is the beautiful moment, right? When we dive into it and see that we've had track record in the space and executive operating partners we can put to work and understanding of the market, and then we team up to do that. I think it's a very interesting market with what's happening with manufacturing. We also are very alert to seeing new opportunities there in healthcare with women and wellness, in consumer with ethnic food, ethnic beauty. And we continue to hone regularly investment thesis around the verticals and continue to always, you know, interact with leaders in the space and players in the space that are honing their visions and their value proposition. And I think it's going to be a very, very interesting year.
All right. Thanks so much, Monica. Well, that's officially a wrap on the 50th episode of the Private Equity Perspectives podcast. I can tell you from hosting 49 of these, this was a really great episode with a ton of value-add content for our listeners to take away. So thank you both for taking the time to join our podcast. I know you're both super busy, but BDO certainly appreciates and values our relationship with both of your firms. And I truly appreciate my personal friendships with both of you. So thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you, Todd.
Thank you so much for inviting us. And I want to say thank you for the role you play, Todd, in the market and BDO as a great partner and service provider. You guys are always there in the trenches with us, introducing us to people, whether they're brokers or good entrepreneurs or good deals, and helping us execute on quality of earnings and all sorts of needs that we have as investors every day. So thank you for the role that you play. As you know, we're based in Miami. The Miami team is amazing. Tony Arguez has been a friend for decades, and you guys are just great partners. So thank you for that. We couldn't do what we do without the work of great partners like you guys.
I second that, Monica. Thank you, Todd.
Thanks again to both of you. To our listeners, thanks so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed the episode. If you haven't already, we'd love for you to subscribe, rate, and leave a review of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, this has been BDO's Private Equity Perspectives.
The views presented by our guests do not necessarily reflect the views of their respective firms.